BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.
Welcome back to BCFM's politics show, Friday Drive Time, with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. The IMF boss under house arrest. But does this have nothing to do with sex, just the opening shots of a battle between the dollar and the euro? And I may live to regret it, but I'm letting Martin Summers off the leash. And we're going to be taking the Israeli-Iranian tensions as the centrepiece, looking at Syria, Iraq, Bahrain, Saudi Arabia, and the so-called Arab Spring to the West. Moving over also to discuss wars in Afghanistan and the world's only nuclear-armed Muslim state, Pakistan, to the east. Plus we hear from one of the British freelance photographers who was running around the streets of Cairo during the Egyptian coup back in January. I'll be asking Martin about selling the philosophy of war, the effect here at home, and how so-called mission creep is going down at the United Nations Security Council. Also asking, is the UN Charter, which was drawn up after World War II, still relevant? But first, BCFM's Steve Satan joins me with his other hat from his Monday show as a transport spokesperson for Rail Futures. Hi, Steve. Welcome to Drive Time.
Hello, Tony.
Now, tell us about Rail Future. What is this Rail Future?
Well, it's just an independent organisation. We campaign for a better deal for railways. We campaign for reopening lines and stations. We want cheaper fares. We want more lorries off the road and onto rail. Who could argue with that?
Nobody. So what about around the city here? What are your main focuses of the campaigning?
There's the Severn Beach line, which is always a sort of hot potato. You know, it's been very successful with the recent, well, I say recent, it was a few years ago now, wasn't it? That the friends of Suburban Bristol Railways managed to squeeze some more money out of the council to put on extra trains, and the passenger numbers are growing. So that's great, but we've got to keep the trains, you know, because they're always under threat from public spending cuts, particularly in the current climate. And the other biggie, I would say, is Portishead, which is, you know, it's such a no-brainer. It takes like more than an hour to drive in from Portishead, and you could do it on the train in 17 minutes if there was a train. So why isn't there?
But it's just clearly not economic.
Well, I disagree. You know, I think there's a very strong case for it, and it may have to be subsidised. But if you look at the wider picture of the sort of social gain and so on, I think there are huge benefits to be had in it, and I think that's true of rail generally.
Now, Sir Roy McNulty has come up with a report on the railways yesterday. What have you sort of discerned from his report, and do you agree or disagree?
Well, we sort of agree with some reservations. The thrust of his report was that the railways in Britain cost about 30 or 40% more to run than equivalent railways in Europe. So there must be something wrong going on.
Yeah, we've got the most expensive rail fares in the world, I'm told.
That may or may not be true. They are certainly amongst the most expensive, yeah. And so what's going on there? There's something wrong. So Roy McNulty was asked to look at it, and he's come up with a few sort of suggestions. You'll be aware of Christian Wolmar, who's a sort of rail journalist and a rail writer. And one of the things he was banging on about was the fragmentation that is inherent in having a privatised railway. And I think there's absolutely no doubt about that, because you've got so many different companies and so many different sort of levels of bureaucracy and so many lawyers involved and so many contracts and so on, that has to, you know, add significant costs to the railway.
But it's not just that, is it? You've got layers of privatisation. You've got the track kind of privatised, then you've got the other companies who actually own the rolling stock, and then that's other companies that are operating. There's layers and layers of these privatised businesses. Each of one is taking a cut, aren't
they? Well, absolutely right. And of course, you know, they've got to sort of draw up contracts and do deals with each other rather than just being one big happy family. So that is one of the suggestions that Roy McNulty came up with. He said, well, look, could we let the train operating companies run the track on their patch, and a so-called vertical integration, and there is some merit in that. And I think he's going to trial it in Wales and East Anglia. And so trialing it again is a good idea, you know, test it rather than just going wholesale. If they tested privatisation, I think we would have realised what a bad idea it was. But it's a two-edged sword. OK, so you get the vertical integration, you get a more integrated rail operation, but we're worried that, firstly, you're further fragmenting Network Rail by breaking it up into regional bodies. Now, that may not necessarily be a good thing. And secondly, that the other people... Of course, any particular line is not just used by one train company. So the train company that managed that bit of line might end up, you know, prioritising their own trains at the expense of their rivals. And we're particularly concerned when it comes to freight about that aspect. It's difficult for the freight operators to find a slot on the railway to run their trains. And if it's going to be even harder, then that means, you know, more lorries on the road and more pollution.
But currently, you need to be a bit of a smarty pants, don't you, to actually work out how to get a reasonable price rail fare from one part of the country to the other. Sometimes you're having to do two single fares because it's like a quarter of the price if you were to get a return, and it seems that for a lot of people it's actually only the people who are claiming company expenses that are using the trains.
It's madness, isn't it? And you do have to jump through hoops to get these deals. And what people want, of course, people want a reasonable price ticket that you can just turn up and go, and of course that's not an option. And the reason for that is that, you know, the rail companies are to some extent trying to manage demand. They are pricing people off the railways. They won't admit it, but they are. If you want to take a peak time rush hour train, then you'll know how eye-wateringly expensive it is. And then the reason for that is that they're trying to encourage you to go at different times.
But you're talking about over £150
easily,
to get
yeah.
to London.
Yeah, yeah, it's shocking. And you know, what's happening is that the passengers are being managed to suit the needs of the rail companies, when of course it should be the other way around. We should be managing the railway to suit the needs of the passengers.
So do you see any way through the woods? Do you see the light at the end of the tunnel?
No, I don't.
No,
I'm afraid I don't. No, there are no easy answers here.
What about just renationalising it?
Well, that ain't going to happen. I mean, there is some merit in that, you know, and there's a lot of people who would advocate it, but...
Bob Crowe is saying this, the leader of the rail union, the RMT, in yesterday's Guardian. He's saying, don't blame the staff, it's privatisation that's failed the railways.
Well, I think there's, like I say, I partly agree with him. Privatisation is one of the factors. McNulty would also argue that Bob Crowe himself is one of the factors as well. He argues that that rail workers in this country are paid too much. So what are we looking at? We're looking at a Tory government who are going to renationalise. Absolutely no way. We're looking at reductions in wages and a big strike, a big fight with Bob Crowe. That's not really a satisfactory outcome. There are no quick fixes. The only long-term solution is long-term investment and long-term planning. And I'd like to see a bit of that, but I'm not that optimistic.
Okay, so I bet you've been swatting up on railways generally. Is there a good place that you can go on the internet, or maybe a periodical where you can actually keep track? If I can use that horrible expression, going on in the world of railways?
Well, you just go to Google News and type in rail. It's probably one of the easiest ways of doing it. If you're looking for cheap tickets, there is a website called Split Your Ticket or something like that, and it'll tell you, you know, some of the deals you can do to get a cheaper fare. There's a bloke called Barry Doe who is a timetable expert, but it's not easy. It should be just, you walk up to the station, you ask for a train ticket to Chippenham and they give you the cheapest deal. But it's
I suppose the one great thing about all this is, because the petrol prices have been going up and up and up the last few months, people are kind of being forced back, possibly even to using the train.
Well, that's certainly true. I mean, the Association of Train Operating Companies issued a report just recently saying exactly that there's been a surprise boost in passenger numbers because of the increasing price of oil. Now, those of us who watch peak oil and oil prices generally, you know, believe that that's only ever going to get any worse. But it's not quite so rosy as that, because of course the government is whacking up the rail fares way ahead of inflation. Next January, rail fares will go up 3% above inflation. So you're damned if you do, and you're damned if you don't. Whichever way you turn, it's to use that old cliche, stuck between a rock and a hard place. Expensive travel. Travel isn't cheap.
So you've got to go and get yourself a car. If you can afford the insurance.
Well, if you can afford the insurance, and if you can afford the increasing cost of oil, you can't win, really.
Okay, it sounds a little bit like kind of almost medieval, like the old stagecoach companies that used to charge a fortune to get from one part of the town, one part of the country to the other. It's almost, we've almost gone back there, haven't we?
You could look at it like that. There is one glimmer of hope, actually. One thing that's happening around here is we're going to get the Great Western Main Line electrified in the next 5 years or so.
Oh, lots of nice maintenance contracts there for
people.
Well,
not at all, because actually, believe it or not, electric trains are cheaper to run, they're cheaper to maintain because they're more reliable. And in terms of fuel costs, they're more efficient, so they're greener and they're faster.
But all that track isn't, is it? Or you've got to keep maintaining all the track. All this stuff hanging on up on these pylons has got to be looked after, hasn't it?
It has, but it still works out cheaper than the diesel engines in the trains. So from that point of view, you know, we will get a faster, more efficient railway in a few years' time, but I can't guarantee that the fares will be
cheaper. How long is it going to take?
About 5 years.
5 years of delays between here and London, really?
Yeah.
Oh, no, you say that is light at the end of the tunnel. No, it's not.
It is, that's the tunnel. There is light at the end.
It's okay. I feel like I'm in the box tunnel right now.
Yeah.
Anyway, we're going to be discussing the Arab Spring and Afghanistan and Pakistan and all things circulating around the Middle East after some music. 1983. Yes, it really was that long ago. Matt Johnson there, from his little band called The, and an album Soul Mining. That was The Uncertain Smile. And Martin Summers has an uncertain smile right now as he looks at the peccadilloes of the head of the IMF, at least alleged peccadilloes of him, Dominique Strauss-Kahn. Now, Martin, can you just tell us who this chap is? I mean, he's French. He's looking like a possible presidential candidate in France.
Yeah, he's part of the kind of elite in France that they call the anarchs, the people who go to the top universities. He is one of them. He's a high flyer. He didn't come from a particularly wealthy background to begin with, but he's pretty wealthy now. He's a champagne socialist, and he was the head of the IMF. Not necessarily the kind of person the Americans would want to see heading the IMF. A bit too pink for their tastes.
Now, traditionally, the Europeans have run the IMF and the Americans have run the World Bank. But the number two is from the opposite side. So now Strauss-Kahn is not running the IMF. The American number two is now in charge of the IMF.
Yes,
right in the middle of some very important
negotiations. Yes, and I understand that Strauss-Kahn was not originally intending to be in New York, but had been called for an emergency meeting by the Americans, which again, and of course they'd arranged his hotel, etc., etc.
One of the things that's really surprised me is within the mainstream press in this country, there's been very little talk of the possible political motives behind this, and any kind of idea of that has been sort of dismissed as, there are some conspiracy theories.
It won't be being dismissed in France, I can assure you.
Well, apparently something like 60% of French people think that there is a political motive behind it.
Yes, well, I mean, it reminds me very much of the case against Eliot Spitzer, Spitzer, who was the district attorney of New York, and he was about to actually bust an awful lot of top financial people for fraud. And just as that was about to come off, he was caught having consensual sex with a high-class prostitute, which led to him being dismissed from his post as district attorney of New York, which was also conveniently meant that all of his prosecutions of the top financial fraudsters were put on the back burner. One has to be suspicious.
Now, one of the things Strauss-Kahn was working on at the International Monetary Fund was a potential consolidation of debt between US and European countries, which would have put, really, I mean, what's going on at the moment is you've got these various individual countries, all of them having to negotiate individually with the IMF, the Portuguese, then the Irish, the Spanish, separately the Greeks. And what this plan would have done was, potentially anyway, we're not saying this would have gone through, would be to put all of these national representatives, finance ministers from all these countries on the same side of a table with the IMF on the other side. Now, that would have quite potentially really changed the power between the IMF and these countries. At the moment, what they're able to do, the IMF, is really kind of divide and rule, and that would have stopped all that.
Yes. I think it's fair to say that Dominique Strauss-Kahn was not one of the good guys, but he was certainly somebody who was looking to make the IMF more responsive to the needs of the debtor countries. And the guy who's Lipsky's name is, I think, who's just taken over, he's a very much a Wall Street man, and he will just demand payment on the nail.
So what would you think if he had remained in his post? Do you think we'd have seen some differences at the big IMF meetings this week?
Well, we're running ahead of ourselves here, because it may be that it's just a series of accidents and the guy did in fact attempt to rape this maid and so on and so on and so forth. He may well have attempted to rape the maid and still be being set up. You know, that's possible to do that with certain people. I mean, looks like Lewinsky, for example, managed to entrap Bill Clinton, because Bill Clinton was the sort of guy who could be entrapped. We just don't know. But clearly, there is a fight going on now for who will take over at the IMF. Angela Merkel, who's the Chancellor of Germany, definitely wants a European. The Chinese and the Indians are saying, no, we definitely don't want a European. The Americans are saying, we want somebody acceptable to us. So, you know, it's a big power struggle.
Okay, so ultimately, this chap was, what he was trying to do, Strauss-Kahn, was to actually consolidate debt. What did he mean by that, and what would have been the difference if he had succeeded in consolidating the debt from these different countries?
To be honest with you, the detail of what he might or might not have have been able to do is difficult for me to discern. What I can discern is that he was definitely different from the usual run-of-the-mill IMF director.
And he was going to be the socialist candidate.
He was going to be a socialist candidate and quite likely elected president of France, and that's all gone by the board now, which means that Sarkozy, of course, is happy. And he, his main challenger has been removed from the game. One of the things Strauss-Kahn did do is he started to say, well, it's okay for countries to have capital controls, because the IMF has been against capital controls for years and years and years. So when your currency is collapsing, you're not allowed to control the inflow and outflow of hot money. And he's saying, no, under emergency circumstances, you can.
Well, can you explain what difference that would make if his policy had been accepted?
What that means is, for example, the Malaysians imposed capital controls in the 1998 Asian crisis, and it meant basically that if you brought your money into the country, you couldn't just take it out again. And also that hot money couldn't flow in. You don't want lots of hot money flowing in to create bubbles and then rushing off again when the bubbles burst. What you want is a steady, basically, people want to invest in your country. You want them to invest in your country and spend money building a factory or building a road or building a sewer. You don't want their money just parked in your currency, which creates all kinds of problems with your interest rate and then just disappearing immediately as soon as any problems emerge. And in the Bretton Woods system as it used to be run from 1945 to 1973, capital controls were normal. Basically, countries controlled the capital inflow, and if you wanted to invest in Britain, we'd say, well, what have you got to offer? And if you haven't got anything to offer, go away.
It doesn't sound like he was a free market economist then. He was talking about restrictions on the free market.
From my point of view, he was a free market economist. But from their point of view, he was a horrid socialist. And that's why they probably removed him, if he has been removed.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.
Well, on to our look now around the Arab Spring and across the other side of the Middle East, also to Afghanistan and Pakistan. And it was on the 25th of January this year that Egypt saw its first mass demonstrations for decades. Freelance photographer Jess Hurd immediately realised the significance of the unfolding events and made sure she was there to capture these things on film as they unfolded. Well, I managed to track down Jess and asked her what it was like working as a photojournalist on the ground as the momentum of events shook the Egyptian establishment.
Jess Hurd, London Photographers Branch of the NUJ. I'm a freelance photographer. I work with an agency called Report Digital. I saw the events that were going on in Tunisia, held off from going there. I'd done work in Egypt beforehand, and so I knew politically in the area, if Egypt went, that would be the key place to go. So as soon as we heard of the first demonstration, we booked flights and went over for the Day of Rage. We made our way over there, arrived the night before, and the Day of Rage was happening from 12 after the mosques, people finished prayers after that. So as soon as we'd got to our hotel, the guy that was working on the desk, he said the week before people were attacked, even praying in the street, because there's not enough room in the mosque, so people actually pray and put their mats down in the street, and police had attacked them there. So it was always going to be a big day, the Day of Rage, that Friday.
Now, I also saw some footage of water cannons actually spraying lines of people as they were actually kneeling down to prayer. But what was your first impression when you arrived and started taking pictures?
We'd made our way to the largest mosque. I mean, we weren't by the Hilton Hotel, that's where they used the water cannons. But as soon as people were coming out, the police were on the streets and using tear gas. So they hadn't actually formed into any demonstration at all. They were just coming out of the mosque, out of the street. So we were with quite a large demonstration that was picking up people going through the streets, photographing it. Myself and Jason Parkinson, video journalist, we were actually the only two journalists on that particular demonstration, so we became targets for the secret police.
What's the difference between what you do and what big news organisations like the BBC do?
Well, a number of my colleagues were there also from the UK, mostly staffers for agencies or staffers for newspapers or contract staff. I'm freelance, so in that sense I'm a lot freer to cover the stories that I want to cover with my own editorial input. So, for example, we were aware that there was a story coming out on the so-called vigilantes. This is, armed individuals in the street, and apparently the media are very wary of these people because they had steel poles and what have you. I hooked up with a woman from the journalist union over there, and we were just walking the streets and her streets, and she knew these people, so we were talking to them, and they're actually elected people to be security for their own community, and all very friendly on a trip back after the first 18 days of the revolution to cover the referendum. We actually went out for a drink with a few of them, and one of them works in a bank as a bank clerk, another works on the cruise ships on the Nile. So, you know, these are hardly, you know, hardened criminal thugs. And that was part of the democracy of the revolution, of people taking part actively and democratically. But it was a story that was mistold by the news media, and it's something that freelancers and independent journalists managed to get out, that the opposite story.
So do you think there's a structural problem in the way that the big media, people like Sky or the BBC, cover these events?
I think there can be a pressure, the 24-hour news pressure, to get a story and a different story out. You know, I think we heard one report of the, is the revolution over, Tahrir Square half empty, and it's like, well, the demo's not till 12 o'clock. Wait and have your story then. You know, the 24-hour news thing really means you have to generate a story, and I think sometimes things may be elaborated.
Now, I know you went down to the Interior Ministry when there was a big protest there. Can you tell us what happened?
Yeah, we'd gone to see a colleague in one of the hotels, and we'd filmed the police firing tear gas into the square in the morning. And what they were doing is trying to draw people down to demonstrate outside the Ministry of the Interior, which was the headquarters of the secret police. There'd been found torture chambers underneath, so it's an absolutely hated building anyway, but it was a trap, and there were snipers in place on the roofs either side of this road, and basically it was a shooting alley. Myself and Jason, again, were I think the only journalists covering down there. Jason was filing to Associated Press, and it was a very risky situation. We didn't realise quite how risky until they were firing at us. We were behind an armoured personnel vehicle and realised we weren't close enough to it because of the angle of the snipers. And in fact, a protester we didn't know, he stood in front of us and was to protect us. He was like, snipers, snipers, which is just incredibly brave. And people were just being gunned down and taken off down a couple of side alleys to a mosque, which was basically a field hospital, and where a lot of people died. And it was just person after person with head injuries. They're clearly, you know, shooting at the head.
If this kind of thing happened in Britain, you'd imagine no one would dare venture out on the streets. It sounds to me as if people were actually almost not afraid of this.
People really breached that fear barrier. I mean, you've got to think that a demonstration of 20 pre the revolution in Cairo was a news story, that the level of oppression and repression by the police and by the state is very, very intense. So people had stepped over that barrier, and people were coming up to us and saying, I'm prepared to die today.
What about now looking back on it, because the military is now really still in charge, and some would argue that not a lot has changed, and that actually effectively what's happened is not really a revolution, it's more of a military coup.
I think it's a revolution in progress, certainly. I mean, when we were back, we were made very aware by some of the journalists that there's also a counter-revolution. There's people attempting to destroy the revolution and destroy its basis by stirring up religious tensions. And it was amazing, actually. We had a hotel right opposite the museum, which was the kind of flashpoint, if you like. It's where the tanks were and where the tanks came in with the army, and people welcomed the army. They're our sons, they're our brothers. They had every confidence that they'd support the revolution. Now, I think that's begun to change. I mean, because we were watching it, it's like, how can they trust the army? They might, you know, are they going to fire on them? Are they not on the protesters? And they didn't, you know, and some units joined in, and some generals actually joined with the other side, and one particular guy was carried around, you know, on people's shoulders for days and days of the revolution. But I think now, yeah, I mean, there's still a curfew. After 12, there's a curfew. You're not allowed to be in the streets. And I think people have made very aware they'll be back on the streets if it's not delivered by the army, that people will demand it again.
Do you think there's any lessons for us over here watching their revolution, or vice versa?
Well, it's interesting because people love the fact that we're from London, and everyone said, oh, are you BBC? You know, the only news agency loved more than BBC is Al Jazeera, I think, over there. And a lot of people said that they saw the student protests, which was fascinating for me, that that are significant but, you know, small on a world scale, could have influenced, and that's quite exciting, you know, in this time of new media, of social networks, that you can generate protests. And
So do you think that's true, that actually people in Egypt were watching what was going on in London and that influenced what was happening over there this year?
Absolutely. I think the world has become much smaller with the Twitter and Facebook. It's actually graffitied on the wall, Facebook and Twitter, in the revolution, which is a bit crazy, but it's a new way of organising. It's the same themes, it's the same politics, but we're able to spread it much more quickly and effectively. Obviously, within the revolution, they shut down the internet, which is another great story, because I was talked to lots of kind of, and they self confessed geeks that had come out onto the streets. They said, well, honestly, if there was the internet, we'd be on Twitter right now, we'd be at home, we'd be on Facebook, but we have to come down to the square to find out what's going on. So they felt they were pulled more into the revolution by the turning off of the internet. It was the trigger to start it. I thought it was great.
That was freelance photographer Jess Hurd there speaking to me a couple of weeks ago. Now Martin Summers is with me still. Martin, she's saying there that they've still got their fingers crossed over there in Egypt. They're relying on the army to sort things out and to actually fulfil the revolutionary aspirations.
Yes, and the army is virtually entirely funded by the United States of America. I think you've got to distinguish, it's a conscript army, so the people at the bottom level probably are pretty sympathetic to the revolution. But the people in charge of the army, I mean, Mubarak used to head up the Egyptian Air Force, they will be looking to retain their privileges. And don't forget, this is ultimately an economic struggle. Millions of people in Egypt live on less than $2 a day. What's the revolution going to do for them? And if it doesn't do something for them, they're going to be demanding something is done. So, you know, it's a revolution in progress. We've got what would be called in the textbooks a Bonapartist regime. The military are in power, holding the centre of the situation, keeping the wealthy happy, but making the masses feel as if their demands are being met. It's inherently unstable.
What about, I mean, talking about inherently unstable, if you look over at Libya, when the borders were originally set in stone, I think after the First World War in Libya, actually it's now, what's happening now is the split between East Libya and West Libya is actually rather like it was before these borders were put in place. Do you think that to a certain extent what's happening is some of the borders that we see on the maps are there, you know, a kind of artificial?
Well, yes, and of course the most artificial of one of all is the border around the State of Israel, which is a completely fungible and keeps being moved and goalposts keep being changed. I mean, it's the same in Africa. I mean, most of these countries were created as a result of shenanigans by imperial powers in 1918, the Sykes-Picot Agreement and so on. And Kurdistan, for example, never got any kind of recognition at all at that period. So, yes, there's a potential for secessionist violence, as we saw in Yugoslavia. And maybe the fact that that Libya has got a fairly clear split between the West and the East tends to suggest that this is, in fact, a civil war. It's not a war by the whole people against the Gaddafi regime. The Gaddafi regime probably does have a degree of support, particularly in the west of the country.
And before we go in to look more closely at the Middle East, sticking with Libya, the British armed forces are now heavily engaged in Libya as part of the NATO-led operation named after some great adventure of classical mythology, Odyssey Dawn. Although not part of Security Council Resolution 1973 that gave permission for a no-fly zone, the object is now regime changed, it seems, by any means. So with one of his sons and three of his grandchildren now killed by NATO's targeting staff, Marina Morris has been out on Bristol streets to see if you too want to see regime change too, and Colonel Gaddafi put on trial.
Should Gaddafi be prosecuted for war crimes?
Yes, he should. He should be prosecuted for war crimes. He's the scourge of society. He's a menace, really, and he does nothing to help the Western policy on human rights.
Yes, then again, there's lots of other people I think should be prosecuted for war crime. Definitely Tony Blair and George Bush.
He's clearly oppressed his people over the last few decades. On the other hand, he's been a very convenient
ally to the West in some situations. He was convenient while he played the game, but now he's not playing the game, so they want to get rid of him. What he's doing with his countrymen, they want freedom, they want democracy, and they're entitled to it. So, yes, we should support them with that. Should he be prosecuted? Probably.
I think he should, yes, but he's obviously a dictator, but if you were 27, you were given the opportunity to overthrow the king and take control of the country and then rule with an iron fist, would you? I probably would.
Oh, absolutely. Yes, definitely. Yeah, you should be.
Should NATO start bombing Libya's infrastructure?
No, that's valuable resources that are neither here nor there, and it doesn't do anything to further the Western cause. I suppose the idea is to cripple Gaddafi's ability to wage war. It starves his hardware. I mean, we need that oil, and I feel that it's neither here nor there, and his oil shouldn't be targeted.
No, because they will actually kill lots of innocent people on the way. Not more than Colonel Gaddafi would ever do.
The only trouble with taking out a country's infrastructure is that it's then got to be rebuilt. The infrastructure then, it affects everyday people. And mostly it's women and children who are going to get affected by that, because they're always at the bottom of the pile. I'm not sure about taking the infrastructure out, because that's going to be a long-term problem which will affect ordinary people much more than the people at the top who have got plenty of money and access to resources.
Ultimately, looking at a way of controlling what he's doing. So I don't know. I think it's a difficult question to answer.
No, I don't think that would really achieve anything. Probably the best way would be to commit to a small, highly trained amount of armed forces on the ground, using like special operations to maybe kidnap or assassinate Gaddafi and his lieutenants. Bombing the infrastructure won't do anything other than just damaging the quality of life for the people of Libya already.
No, because civilians could get hurt. But at the same time, they've got to have a country after Gaddafi's gone. They take everything away. It's not so good, is it?
Should the Royal Air Force stop its bombing?
No, because we don't want to hit civilians, but at the same time, I feel that the only way to remove Gaddafi is to target him specifically, and I feel Gaddafi should be targeted because he's a war criminal and he needs to be stopped and he needs to be removed.
Yes, because I really think they're not going for the good attention. If he was really for the people, I would have been really up for it, but I don't believe it. I don't believe it.
Targeted bombing to take out Gaddafi's troops and his weapons stores, then yes, go for it, but I think it should be very targeted, not just willy-nilly. But of course, I mean, there's going to be mistakes, because whilst we all love to rely on technology, it's not 100%. I think maybe they should carry on to take out weapons dumps. Yeah,
it depends on what the ultimate outcome is. If it's purely to knock down a country so we can go and rebuild it, then there's no benefit in that. But if it's to stop Gaddafi instructing his troops to do things to his people, then there's benefit in it. So again, I don't think it's a yes or no question. It really depends on what the outcome is.
They're going to run out of targets pretty soon, I think. But again, I think they just need to have, again, like a measured and mediated approach, and make sure they're only hitting things that are really going to affect the military capacity of Gaddafi's forces. If they know where the targets are, and if they're of high value to our strategic ends, which is the downfall of Gaddafi, then yeah, they should bomb them.
Well, we've also heard today about the bombing of several of Gaddafi's ships, which really falls outside, arguably, the UN resolution for a no-fly zone. And the infrastructure, of course, there will be Western companies sort of wringing their hands thinking, oh, well, we can rebuild infrastructure if they want to bomb it. Martin Summers, what do you think about this whole business of mission creep from the original 1973 resolution passed at the United Nations in Libya?
Well, as you know, Tony, I was in two minds about this situation when it first occurred. I was seeing the Libyan protesters as part of the Arab Spring. I got no brief for Gaddafi particularly, and I was actually possibly in favour of a no-fly zone to prevent him carrying out massacres of civilians. And I worked under a no-fly zone when I was an aid worker in Bosnia, and basically what that meant was that the Serbs couldn't use their aircraft. They could use everything else, but they couldn't use their aircraft. But crucially, what we were doing on the ground in Bosnia is we were saying to everybody, please stop shooting, let's have a negotiation. Now, there is absolutely no UN resolution for regime change in Libya. That's definitely not part of the resolution. So all of these people saying, well, we've got to get rid of Gaddafi, that's our goal, goal. Well, it may be our goal, but that's absolutely not the goal of the United Nations. So if there is attempts at regime change, and that's clearly what's going on, that is clearly outside the scope of the resolution, as the Russians and the Chinese have pointed out.
Well, they're calling for a ceasefire, aren't
they? They're indeed calling for a ceasefire. Now, what's turned it around for me is the discovery a couple of weeks ago on the French Air Force website, and everybody can look this up. They've just got to Google it or use any other search engine. Southern Mistral 2011. And there, in English, on the French Air Force website, you will find that there was a war game planned from November last year against an imaginary country called Southland, which bears a surprising similarity to Libya, with a dictator who represses his people after a peaceful uprising. It turns to fighting, and then a UN resolution is passed, and then the French and British Air Forces wade in. That's all in the war game scenario of Southern Mistral 2011, put together in November last year before the first demonstrator's foot walked down an Egyptian street. And of course this does raise questions about the whole Arab uprising and the timing of it. What I've said to people is you've got to imagine that in all of these Arab countries you've got a huge reservoir of discontent that's been building up for a very long time. In Switzerland they have avalanches every year, and some of them get so big that they can destroy small towns. So what they do, they've got a whole squad of people who go up there and they throw dynamite on the avalanches and make them come down before they destroy small towns. I think what's going on is that the CIA's May 68 unit, if I can call it that, has decided that there was going to be revolutions in the Arab world anyway, so we might as well have them on our timescale and according to our agenda. And we know for a fact that the National Endowment for Democracy and various other American groups are funding the demonstrators. That's not to say that the demonstrators don't have a right to demonstrate or to change their societies, but let's be clear, the Americans are pumping massive amounts of money into this process. And the attack on Libya was planned in advance, which means that they must have been working with the armed rebels in advance, and they probably planned with them for it to turn into fighting. Now, there's a big difference between peaceful demonstrators being shot down and people shooting policemen and all the rest of it. That's the difference between the IRA and the Social Democratic and Labour Party, if you like. Now, if the West has been fomenting armed rebellion in Libya and Syria and then saying, "Ooh, look, isn't it terrible, people are being killed," that is despicable. And the war crimes are actually to be found on our side, not on their side. The Libyans had just had a UN report on their human rights record, which said that they'd made massive improvements in recent years. Obviously not enough for some people.
Now, moving eastwards a little bit, you mentioned Syria briefly there. What about the countries in the Arabian Peninsula, like Saudi Arabia, Bahrain and Yemen, and then also looking at Lebanon and Syria?
Well, I mean, you've got a whole slew of countries there. What's very significant about Obama's speech yesterday is that not one word was mentioned about Saudi Arabia, which is the most repressive of all of these countries, and of course the closest allied to us. In Bristol, for example, many people in Filton are basically working to supply the Saudis with weaponry paid for by the Saudi autocrats, and it's keeping us happy. It's putting money in British pockets, wealthy people making a lot of packet out of the Saudis, so we can't mention them. Why not? Why ever not?
What about Libya and Syria, closer to the Israel-Palestine situation?
Well, Syria is obviously has been a target for destabilisation by the West for a long time. Now, I don't know what's going on in Syria. It's silly to sit in a Bristol radio studio and presume you can say. But let's face it, the regime in Libya and Syria hasn't crumbled, have they? They have got some support on the ground in those countries. And it's futile to imagine that they are just going to disappear because we don't like them.
Now let's move over and have a look a bit more closely at Afghanistan and Pakistan, which are, you know, over to the east of the of Iran. Now we have obviously our troops in Afghanistan, but increasingly it seems that there's tensions in Pakistan, where which obviously, you know, NATO needs to get supplies through to Afghanistan, etc. But there's a real problem now with the relationship with Pakistan, which of course is the world's only Muslim nuclear armed country.
Yes, I think it's rather significant that basically out there in the big wide world, folks, nobody believed that Osama bin Laden was killed last week. Nobody. You may believe it if you're listening to this radio show, but I can tell you for a fact that most people in Pakistan, Russia, Africa, they don't believe it. They think it's American propaganda. What's significant about the Osama operation was that it was right next to the Pakistani military training college, their Sandhurst. And I see it as the Americans throwing a gauntlet down to the Pakistani military. And if you remember, there was an incident a few weeks ago where an American agent was caught red-handed shooting people in the street, possibly ISI agents who were following him.
He was working with XC, the Blackwater.
Yes, he was a Blackwater guy. They tried to claim he was a diplomat and get
private military
immunity and all the rest of it.
Private military company, which is employed.
If you read the Pakistani English language press, as I do, on the internet, Dawn, the Daily Jang and so on, you will know that the Pakistani police, from his phone records, knew that he'd been in contact with all the top terrorist groups in Pakistan in the previous 2 weeks. Many educated people in Pakistan believe that the CIA and Mossad, the Israelis, are working with terrorists inside Pakistan to destabilise the country, to blow things up, to get the situation further down the line so that there's an excuse for intervention. And the motive behind that is the Pakistanis are basically planning with the Chinese to build an oil pipeline to the Indian Ocean, which the Americans don't want to see happen. And so they're destabilising Pakistan to prevent the Chinese getting their hands on Middle East oil.
Now, with the whole business of Afghanistan, obviously there's been questions about whether actually it was any point connected to 9/11 there was any reason to actually be in Afghanistan. Despite what we see and hear in our newspapers and television screens, there are growing numbers of patriotic US military veterans who are deeply opposed to US foreign policy in Afghanistan and elsewhere. They're calling themselves Iraq Veterans Against the War, and one of IVAW's senior speakers is retired Marine Lieutenant Colonel Shelton Langford. He believes that corporate interests, referred to Dwight D. Eisenhower in his closing address when he was US President, as the military industrial complex, and he's saying that they have paralysed democracy now in the United States and virtually taken over the US government. Let's hear from him now.
My name is Shelton Langford. I'm a retired Lieutenant Colonel in the United States Marine Corps, a naval aviator. I have over 10,000 hours of flight time. And I'm a Vietnam veteran with over 300 combat missions flown. I'm also a charter signatory of a petition calling for a new investigation into the events of September 11, 2001. When I raised my right hand to be sworn in as a new second lieutenant in 1964, I promised to defend the Constitution of the United States of America from all enemies, foreign and domestic. I have not been notified yet of my having been relieved of that duty. In this context, I want to mention one of my favorite Marine Corps heroes, Major General Smedley Darlington Butler. General Butler was held up to prospective officers in my Marine science classes as an exemplar of the courage, devotion to duty, and sense of honor expected of all Marines. He was twice awarded the country's highest military decoration, the Medal of Honor. And his skill and bravery in battle was legendary. That was all I knew about General Butler until long after I had retired from the Marine Corps. I learned the rest of his story from a written version of speeches he made after he left the service. In those speeches, which appeared later under the title of War is a Racket, published in 1935 and reissued in 2003, he confessed that his Marine Corps campaigns had much in common with the hired thugs employed by the notorious gangsters of his day, and that his military in Haiti, Nicaragua, and Cuba safe for the bankers and United Fruit. He inveighed bitterly against war profiteers and foresaw the rise of militarism and the military-industrial complex, spurred on by the greed of arms manufacturers and those who supply the wasteful consumption of war to their great profit, and the impoverishment of both American citizens and the countries upon which our martial attentions are visited. Our current conflict would, no doubt, look familiar to him. But his finest hour, in my opinion, was when he became a whistleblower, exposing a plot to overthrow the government headed by Franklin D. Roosevelt of the United States. with the intent of replacing it with a fascist dictatorship. The industrialists and financiers behind the effort attempted to recruit him to lead a large contingent of veterans to form a military wing of the plot. They picked the wrong Marine.
That was Shelton Langford, former Lieutenant Colonel in the US Marines there speaking, and he's from Iraq Veterans Against the War. Now, Martin Summers, we were talking about the military taking over in Egypt a little while ago, and there's Shelton Langford saying that the military-industrial complex in America has also become way too powerful.
Yes, I mean, the attempted coup in the 1930s is not widely known about, but Prescott Bush, the grandfather of G.W. Bush, and it's Prescott spelt with a double T, you can look this up on the internet, he was one of the main conspirators to try and bring in a fascist government in the United States in the 1930s, blocked by the US Marines, head of the US Marines, General Smedley Butler.
So, Martin, I mean, have NATO and through our alliance with the United States, have we started to become the evil empire?
Well, it looks like it, doesn't it? I mean, I think people who are interested in these topics should go to Military Officers for 9/11 Truth, a website that came up last November. There you will see hundreds of US military officers asking for a new inquiry into what happened on 9/11.
Now, Shelton, at the end of the Second World War in 1945, senior Nazis suspected of being war criminals were rounded up by the Allied occupying forces. Apart from those who were spirited away to the United States as part of Operation Paperclip, most were put on trial for their crimes. One of the prosecutors back at Nuremberg was Benjamin Ferencz, and he was on Canadian national radio this week explaining what he thought about the attempted assassination, whether it's real or not, of Osama bin Laden and this whole quick and easy approach to assassinating our enemies.
The laws of war are very unclear. We hide behind euphemistic phrases. We kill a lot of civilians and we say, oops, sorry about that, that was collateral damage. Now, I have no doubt that the American army goes to extreme means to try to avoid what they call collateral damage and what I would call negligent homicide or manslaughter. And even though we invent new methods of warfare, such as nuclear warfare, or what's coming next from cyberspace, paralyzing the electrical networks of whole cities so that you cannot distinguish. My personal answer is to these problems is to end war making and go back to what the law is, and that is you cannot use armed force to settle your disputes. You can use only lawful and peaceful means for doing that.
What would you have liked to have seen happen then with Osama bin Laden?
I would like to have seen happen then what we did with Eichmann. We find a man who was a notorious criminal, what incidentally I did in the war. I've been in those shoes. I was a combat soldier, sergeant of infantry, assigned to gather the evidence of the war crimes in the concentration camps and beyond. So I would have liked to have seen them do what we were required to do and did. And that is, you apprehend him, if you can, without danger to yourself. Put him on trial. Let him make his case. Let him state to the world why they killed 3,000 people in New York City and many thousands elsewhere, and see how the public and the judges react to it. There will be, of course, some extreme elements on both sides which will say, no, kill him at once. He's a dirty dog and he deserves to be shot. And there'll be others who will say, no matter what you do, that he is our holy man and he is carrying out noble goals. But these will be the extreme cases. The vast majority of the people will say, when the evidence is in, that this is a form of madness. You cannot kill an ideology with a gun.
That was Benjamin Ferencz, one of the prosecutors in the Nuremberg trials after the Second World War. Very briefly then, Martin, where is all this leading if we carry on down this road? Because you've talked about a possible war coming out of this.
Well, of course, the potential for World War III is staring us in the face. What's very important, of course, is if you put Osama bin Laden on trial, it may turn out that what's actually happened is very different from the story we've been told. His defence lawyers are going to say, yes, he did do it with the collaboration of the CIA, for example. Now, that's why you have to have trials, because otherwise you don't know what's happened.
OK, well, that's all for this week. Thanks very much, Martin Summers. And coming up next, the Sky News at 7 o'clock. Thanks very much to our guests also in the first hour. New councillor for St George West, just crowned leader of the Labour group on Bristol City Council. That was on broadband internet to Steve Satan. And also, if you're on broadband internet, you can hear all our previous Friday drive times, including this programme's five-point economic recovery plan, our report on mobile phone masts and safety of wireless networks, as well as evidence of Masonic corruption in the police. An extended interview with managing editor of BBC Radio Bristol. Go to thisweek.org.uk and click on the link to our archives. That's enough talk for tonight. Friday night is music night. I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. And be back next week.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol